the seven factors of enlightenment, or the seven factors of awakening. And what these factors are characteristics that one develops or nurtures as one progresses in the meditative practice, leading all the way up to, you know, spiritual sort of awakening or enlightenment. They describe several things. They describe mental states that we try to nurture through the meditative practice, as well as levels of attainment, levels of realization that we achieve as we deepen into the practice. And it's a sort of a cumulative process. In other words, one factor leads to the next. As it gets developed, it leads to the next factor, which leads to the next. And these seven factors, they begin with mindfulness. So mindfulness is really the foundation of this whole process. What this process, or what this series describes, is what happens as we develop in mindfulness. So the mindfulness, what's establishing the mindfulness, these are the characteristics, sort of stages of development that we're able to achieve, you know, as we deepen into the practice. So the first is establishing mindfulness. The second is investigation. The quality of being able to investigate, you know, what's arising. You know, just the openness, the clarity of mind that allows you to begin to look at, see, experience, and feel whatever arises within yourself. You know, the whole thing to understand about the meditation process is that it's a very intense process of self-examination. Okay? It's not about getting into some beautiful, rapturous, blissful state, although that can happen. And oftentimes that becomes a seduction in the practice, because as you get deeper in the practice, you can get into rapturous, blissful states. But that's not the point of the practice, at least in terms of mindfulness. There are practices which do emphasize, you know, that aspect of, you know, the meditation. But this is something that's part of what one experiences in the meditation process. But in terms of mindfulness meditation, which is the form of meditation that the Buddha himself developed, so this is a particular kind of meditation, in the sense that it's not, you know, Hindu meditation or other forms of meditation, but this is, you know, mindfulness meditation, so-called vipassana or insight meditation. So investigation becomes a very important aspect of this process. Once you establish the mindfulness, we begin to investigate, you know, things that arise. Then out of this investigation process arises sort of reservoirs of energy. You know, there's a kind of sustaining energy that begins to develop as the process begins to deepen. Now, this is a wonderful aspect of the practice in the sense that it begins to self-motivate. When you start to feel the benefits of the practice, both in terms of the deepening of the concentration and the ability to see things, you know, that one begins to see, you know, as one deepens in the practice, it develops a certain kind of enthusiasm. You know, it's like a sustainable practice, right? I mean, it develops its own energy and it kind of its own momentum. And it's a very powerful aspect of the practice. And there are many people in this room, you know, who have that, who are at that level where the practice itself becomes, you know, self-motivating, self-generating, you know, practice. It's not just something you do out of obligation. It's something that you want to do, something that becomes an important part of your life. Then out of that, as you develop this depth of energy and investigation, we come into states of rapture and bliss. The rapture and bliss, but it's not just, you know, like kind of a high thing, but it's a kind of joy. It's a kind of happiness. It's a rapturous happiness that you, you know, it's not just like a high, you know, getting stoned or something, but it's a high that we feel from life, from the experience of being alive. So it's a real kind of experienced-based sort of happiness. Then out of that comes tranquility, a sense of tranquility and peace, and rapture. So there's a beautiful aspect to this. And then ultimately it rises to equanimity. Equanimity is the highest sort of virtue, if you will, in the sense that it implies a kind of complete openness, a complete willingness to accept all things as they are. It's not a kind of neutrality, it's not a kind of indifference, but it's a complete open-hearted acceptance of all things, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, or happy or unhappy, or even catastrophic. You know, we accept all things that arise, and we have this ability to move through, see things in their intrinsic sort of truth. And in that sense, it allows us to accept all things as they arise, whether they're negative or positive or fortunate or unfortunate. There's a deeper kind of logic. There's a deeper kind of understanding and wisdom that allows us to accept all of these things with a sense of equanimity, serenity, and peace. So this is the kind of process that is described by these seven factors of enlightenment. Now, basically, the word mindfulness is translated in Pali as sati, S-A-T-I. And this whole practice is called satipatthana, or the four foundations, the foundations of mindfulness. So this is called mindfulness practice. Now, one of the most useful sort of breakdowns of the concept of mindfulness was presented by a British writer by the name of R.M.L. Geffen, who is a British scholar. And he wrote a book in which he sort of scanned or studied all of the sutras, all of the teachings, Abhidhamma, for whatever references there were to mindfulness, sati. So, in other words, to get an idea of how the concept of sati is referred to, you know, throughout the breadth of the Buddhist teachings. And he came up with basically four sort of definitions, four ways in which this concept of mindfulness is discussed. And it's a very, you know, wonderful, sort of concise, sort of enlightening presentation. So I'd like to present these four. Now, generally, we understand the concept of mindfulness as meaning attentiveness to the present moment. But the original sort of Pali term, sati, has the root term is memory. So it's a sense of remembering. There are four sort of ways in which memory is evoked in the process of mindfulness. So the first was remembering in the sense of not losing or forgetting what is in front of the mind. Okay, so, you know, if we're focusing on an object, we're focusing on the breath, and we're trying to concentrate the mind, we're trying to, you know, quiet the mind, sort of come into silence and stillness. But we're constantly led adrift, right? Our thoughts are constantly pulled away, and we constantly tend to forget. We constantly lose sight of what we're trying to focus on. So it's this ability to maintain, you know, awareness of the object and not forget, not fall off the cart, as it were, fall off the wagon and, you know, wander down some path, which is what we do all the time. So this ability to stay with the object, not forget the object. The second is presence of mind, in the sense of the mind, you know, stays on the object, and it guards the mind from extraneous information, you know, noise, memories, emotions, thoughts that keep intruding into the mind. So it's like a sentinel, you know, that stands at the city gates. The third aspect is calling to mind or remembering what is skillful and what is not skillful. It's a very important one in terms of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, what is skillful, what is harmful and what is not harmful, what is skillful and what is not skillful. So this kind of brings in a sort of moral, ethical dimension, you know, into the whole practice. So this is a very crucial aspect, you know, of the practice in terms of beginning to evaluate, you know, what it is that we're experiencing as it arises, you know, during the meditation process. And the fourth, which is actually, in my estimation, probably the most important, and it's this association with understanding and wisdom. So the mindfulness, you know, the seeing, the quality of seeing that we experience associates with understanding and then ultimately to wisdom. Okay, so there's this link between seeing something, and as we see it, that seeing evoking a sense of understanding, right? I mean, we start to understand what we're seeing or feeling, and that understanding sort of arriving into a larger sense of wisdom about ourselves, you know, through the experience of feeling what we've been experiencing. And there's a quality about this which is called seeing things as they truly are. And this is really the sine qua non of this whole practice. You know, seeing things as they actually are. And this is so, so important. And this is the essence, you know, of what mindfulness is in terms of what we try to achieve through the mindfulness process. And that is this ability to actually experience things as they truly are, and not through the lens of our discursive mind. What that means is we have gone through a process where mentally, through the meditative process, that we've been able to literally quiet the mind of all our discursive, random discursive thinking. You know, the stuff that goes on 24/7, you know, the unconscious thoughts and emotions and feelings that are constantly coursing through the mind, which we're most of the time completely unaware of. But this is how the mind works. We're constantly, you know, we call it radio mind, monkey mind. So the beginning of the practice, in the beginning of the practice, and this is called concentration practice, which is preliminary to mindfulness practice, and this is something that we do here. We give a lot of emphasis to. The preliminary practice is the practice of just simply quieting the mind down. So we're not just sitting there daydreaming, you know, and just thinking about stuff and, you know, as you say, lost in the past or buried in the future, or, you know, sort of going back and forth, or sitting here but being in San Francisco or Waikiki or someplace else. So having the mind in the moment, here, now, and still, silent, quiet. So this is a practice in and of itself. And it's called concentration. So we're developing concentration. Now, when the mind does get to that point, which it does, you know, if you give the practice, you know, if there's a commitment, a sincere commitment to the practice, and you do this over time, there isn't anybody who can't do this. You know, if there's a clear understanding of what you're doing, and there's a clear commitment and intention to do the practice, to gain the benefit of, you know, quieting the discursive mind down. This is not about religion or spirituality. This is just about, you know, mental health. Okay, so if you're stressed out, if you're anxious, if you're full of fear, or all kinds of emotions are going on, you know, this is what you do to sort of calm the mind down, basically. Now, when you do come to that level of concentration, you know, and there are various terms, it's called samadhi, or, you know, one-pointedness of mind, or, you know, they call it access concentration or neighborhood concentration. It's not as if the mind is turned off. You know, the mind is still alive. It's just that all the chatter, you know, on the surface is gradually, you know, sort of calmed down. And what that actually does is it gives more internal sort of psychic room for other material that may be further down in your subconscious or even unconscious to begin to arise to the surface. And, you know, you're sitting in a state of kind of open awareness. It's a sort of neutral state. You're focusing on an object, and you're quieting the mind down. You're actually creating a kind of venue, you know, for thoughts and emotions to arise from a deeper level. Oftentimes they do, you know, like anxiety, fear, anger, envy, jealousy. But the difference this time is that when you're sitting in a state of concentration and the mind is very clear and very still, as these emotions arise, you're seeing them with a kind of clarity. You know, in other words, you're not immediately reacting or judging or saying this is good, this is bad, or this reminds me of such and such and so, and oh, I don't like this. You know, in other words, the mind is not starting to spin out, but it's just sitting there observing these emotions as they arise. So you're seeing it, you know, literally with the glasses taken off as it is. And if the focus and the concentration is very, you know, very clear and very connected, you know, it arises not only as an intellectual thought, but as a, you know, kinesthetic experience in the body. In other words, you're feeling it in the body. So your sense of connectedness, you know, becomes almost as if you become that emotion or you become that feeling. And when you start to see with that kind of clarity, you know, there's no way you're not going to be affected by that experience. This is called an epiphany. This is called insight. This is the insight of insight meditation. So this is what is implied when we speak of mindfulness. Mindfulness is that kind of clear seeing, right? Once that kind of clear seeing starts to occur, you know, it begins to open the door to investigation, to energy, rapture, bliss, boom, 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 right down the line. But you've got to open the door first. And the only way you can open the door is by quieting the discursive mind. Because the noise of the mind is what obscures, you know, obscures yourself from connecting to what's happening deeper within yourself. So the whole purpose of the meditative process, or the whole purpose of the mindfulness process, is to get ourselves to the point where we can start seeing, you know, this deeper emotional, psychic, you know, information that lies within us. And of course, as we start to see it in that way, you know, it opens the door to greater self-understanding, you know, greater wisdom, and compassion, acceptance, ultimately forgiveness. So this is where the whole process can be transformative. This is how transformation starts to happen, you know, as the practice deepens. So the word mindfulness is a very powerful word. It implies a lot. So I wanted to make sure that we're all sort of on the same page when we talk about mindfulness, because it's not just paying attention and being aware, but it's being aware in a particular way. And it's an awareness that's cultivated through practice, right? Through concentration practice and focused awareness. In the teaching, there are two terms. One is called access awareness, and one is called sustained awareness. As we focus on the object, you know, we bring the attention to the object, it's called access awareness, where, you know, accessing the awareness of the object. Then once the, you know, awareness is begun, then we have to sustain that awareness over time. And the analogy that's given in the teachings of this is kind of humorous, is if you take a ball of mud, you know, and you take some earth and you take some water and you kind of, you know, sort of roll it up in your hand, and then you throw it at a wall, you know, with high velocity. If you have too much water, of course, you know, it'll just splatter and then just kind of, you know, roll down the wall. If you have too little water, you know, it's too hard, you know, it'll hit the wall and it'll just bounce off. So you have to have just the right amount of water and earth mixed together, just the right consistency. And when you throw it against the wall, it's, you know, hits the wall and it sticks. It sits there. So it's that kind of, you know, it's a wonderful analogy because it implies a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of focus, and a certain amount of effort, you know, to keep the mind right on the object and sustained. It's not just kind of like zoning out. I mean, it's a very purposeful process. So when you stay on the breath, you know, when you stay on the object, you know, in the mindfulness, in the concentration practice, we focus on the breath, okay? So we stay with the breath, you know, as thoughts, feelings, emotions arise, we note them, we let them go. So it's a mind-clearing kind of process. Whereas in mindfulness, say we're in a state of concentration and we're on the breath, say a powerful emotion arises. This time, instead of just noting it and letting it go, we shift our focus to whatever's arising. With the same concentrated focus that we had on the breath, we bring that focus to, you know, whatever's arising, whether it's an emotion, a sensation, a sound, and we just focus on that. And then once it begins to pass away, as it eventually does, then we bring it back to the breath. So this is the, you know, the sort of difference, the sort of methodological difference between mindfulness and concentration in terms of how you focus your awareness. So, but all the time, the awareness is focused, it's strong and sustained all the time. So that takes a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of commitment, you know, and a certain amount of, you know, sort of dedication to the practice. So it's not about just, you know, kind of zoning out, which is a lot of, sometimes a lot of people think, oh, but you just sit there and, you know, kind of zone out. It's just the opposite. It's a very focused, purposeful kind of practice. The second aspect is the quality of standing near the mind or guarding the mind. So it's often spoken of as the watchman of the mind's door, so that we don't get caught up in mindlessness, you know, like allowing the mind to drift off, you know, into thoughts and feelings and going on long rides, you know, to faraway places. The third is calling to mind or remembering what is skillful or not. What is skillful or not? Is it skillful or unskillful? Is it wholesome? Is it unwholesome? Is it you know, positive or negative? You know, what are the implications? You know, what are the sort of karmic implications of this emotion, this experience that I'm having? So obviously it means abandoning what is unwholesome and embracing what is wholesome. Obviously, there's a choice here. I mean, when we do this practice because we want to cultivate wholesomeness. We want to cultivate skillfulness, happiness, equanimity. There are positive sort of kind of moral reasons why we do this practice. We want to free ourselves from suffering, from unhappiness. So there's a natural moral assumption, you know, in the practice. Now, the thing about this, which is how it connects, is that the knowledge of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome is based on memory. It's based on conditioning. Like we remember that if we do this, you know, this will have negative effects. If we do that, it'll have positive effects. Now, some of this is karmically conditioned in the sense that, you know, what is regarded as wholesome in one context could, you know, might be regarded as unwholesome in another, or reverse. What might be regarded as unwholesome in one context could be regarded as wholesome. But the bottom line, however, is that if we don't have this sense of what is wholesome and unwholesome, the phrase is, we are simply tossed about on the waves of our mental habits and conditioning, often acting out our latent tendencies and defilements. And what that means is, most of the times we go through life conditioned by the values of our society, our culture, our family, that tell us what is right, what is wrong, what is good, and what is bad. And from culture to culture, you know, this can be different. So this is a very unique sort of process, you know, for each individual in each culture. But, for example, to choose an extreme example, say you took Al-Qaeda, okay, from an American perspective, as opposed to taking Al-Qaeda, say, from an Egyptian perspective. From an American perspective, most people say, they're all terrorists, right? They're out to destroy the American way of life. So they're our enemy. And so we have a whole, you know, government superstructure of policies and blah, 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 to monitor, apprehend, capture, kill, jail, blah, 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 anybody who might be, you know, regarded as a terrorist, okay? So that's a culturally conditioned view of these people, you know, who we believe who are out to destroy the American way of life. That's a culturally conditioned view. Now, if you were to look at it from the point of view of, I'm trying to remember the name of the second in command to Osama bin Laden, the Egyptian, I can't remember his name. But anyway, he was a doctor. He was a highly educated man. And he was, he and Osama bin Laden and the people of, you know, of his generation were caught up in sort of the Egyptian politics of pre-Mubarak, you know. At the time, this was like in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when, you know, the oil interests in the United States, oil interests were becoming established in the Middle East, and this whole elite structure of sheikhs and mullahs and everything were coming up in terms of controlling the whole oil infrastructure, and, you know, this whole, the oil age was being born, right? And what happened was it created this incredibly bifurcated society in which there was this incredibly wealthy elite, you know, that was benefiting from the oil, the whole oil economy, and then there was this lower strata of just abject poverty, people who were completely outside, you know, the oil economy. And plus it was it was almost an archaic Islamic, you know, kind of a very fundamentalist kind of, you know, religious social structure, so that millions of people were living in abject poverty and total oppression, you know. This is how, you know, so this is the ground out of which Osama bin Laden and, you know, these people came from. And they saw, you know, the cause of all of this was the lust for oil and, you know, and sort of powering the whole industrial revolution and the automobile age in the United States, the massive consumption, materialism, and all the hedonistic pleasures of the American way of life. Of course they would come to hate America, because America basically created all their suffering, all the economic disparities and polarization and political oppression that they were experiencing because of all the political elite that was trying to control the oil money. And so how do you look at it, right? You know, it's like, so these are different perspectives. Now, if you were growing up poor in Egypt in the 1970s, you know, you probably would have joined Al-Qaeda and you probably would have hated the Americans. So this is what conditioning is. Okay, so where is the truth in this? You know, this is all the stuff of contemporary society, contemporary politics, contemporary economics, right? This is conditioned sort of conventional reality. What is the ultimate reality in all this? What is the truth in all this? The truth is we're all human beings struggling, you know, to survive, to be happy, to understand who we are, to live, you know, meaningful lives. And we're all subject to conditions, right, that led to whatever happened in our lives. So if you looked at Osama bin Laden from the point of view of how he got to be where he was and why he did what he did, you probably could understand that. You could probably sympathize, you know, with how he felt. Of course, you know, you couldn't allow him to go on just killing people, but it would allow you to sort of see him in a whole different light, with a certain kind of wisdom, a certain kind of expansiveness, a certain kind of understanding, right, that would allow you to be more compassionate, that would allow you to be wiser and more forgiving and accepting in terms of working with people to address the kinds, you know, of evils, the kinds of disparities and the kinds of conditions that created that violence, that created that oppression, that created those kinds of circumstances. So this is what I mean in terms of that sense of how we act out of our latent tendencies and conditioning. We don't see this bigger picture. So for us, it's about just kill bin Laden or kill these guys. Or, you know, we have these programmed, you know, sort of conditioned views of reality. And so do they. You know, they say kill all Americans, right? So, you know, this is the world we live in. So mindfulness can help us to begin to move past these conditioned responses and to see the larger reality, right? And skillfulness, you know, the wholesomeness, the unwholesomeness, we start to see this in a whole different light, you know, when we have this larger view of reality. A very, very important concept with regard to this whole thing about skillfulness and unskillfulness is the concept of iri and otapa. Now, these are Pali terms, iri, H-I-R-I, and otapa is O-T-T-A-P-A. Now, what they mean is moral shame and moral dread. Iri means moral shame, and otapa means moral dread. These are two concepts that the Buddha has called the guardians of the world. So he gives a lot of importance, you know, to the concept of shame and the concept of dread. Shame is the feeling of repugnance, just repugnance of bodily and moral misconduct. Bodily and moral misconduct. It's like repugnant. You don't even want to go there. You know, bodily and moral misconduct, the sense of just repugnance of any kind of moral or unethical conduct, or remorse or shame about any kind of unwholesome action. So there's a high standard of moral clarity, ethical clarity. And dread is, it's called a wise fear of wrongdoing with respect to future consequences and the opprobrium or disapproval of the wise. You know, is this something that wise people, people whose opinions I respect, are going to disapprove of, you know, blame me for doing these kinds of things? The net result, of course, is to pull us away from unwholesome deeds and sort of, you know, pull us more toward wholesome, skillful actions, is that it's not about feeling guilty or unworthy about things. I mean, in our culture, we tend to have a real negative attitude toward shame and guilt. I mean, you know, you don't want to feel guilty, you don't want to get caught up in, you know, these kinds of negative self-images of yourself, feeling unworthy or shameful or guilty. And this is a very important thing. We don't want to sort of get caught up in concepts or feelings of low self-esteem based on unworthiness or not living up to societal standards or doing things that we think we are expected or ways in which we ought to be behaving in ways that other people might expect. You see what I'm saying? And so we get stuck in that. And so that causes, you know, these feelings of low self-esteem, shame, and feeling of moral dejection and marginalization. And this can happen. And so, you know, we're often sort of counseled, you know, not to feel that way, you know, to feel proud, to feel good, you know, to build your sense of self-esteem, to build your sense of personhood, you know, in the world. But this is different from the concept of iri and otapa in the way that's being discussed, because there's a sense of what is appropriate, you know, within the culture that can be defined as, you know, acceptable behavior. It really is based on a deep caring and respect for ourselves and for others. So the point about this is really important, is that it extends the realm of our concern out of ourself toward others. In other words, we are concerned about people whose opinions we respect, we are concerned about those opinions in terms of how they reflect on us and how they allow us to act in a skillful, you know, sort of wholesome manner as opposed to an unskillful or unwholesome way. So it's a standard of behavior that inspires wisdom and restraint in times of stress. The real important point about this is the sense that it places us smack in the middle of our karmic relationships with other people. In other words, we don't make decisions based solely on our own self-interest or our own perceived pleasure or, you know, what we like or don't like. But we make these decisions based on how it affects other people. And this is really an important aspect of the practice in the sense that, as well as in Buddhism, in the sense that it's not about ourselves totally. I mean, it is about ourselves in the sense that we are responsible for, you know, the consequences of our own actions. But we exist within a realm of karmic relationships with others that cannot be ignored. So it's this whole notion of self and other. So it's this dynamic sort of dialectic, if you will, between the integrity of the self and the relationship with other. And this is really, really crucially important to understand that these have to be in balance. That we don't ever do anything that does not have a karmic impact on other people. We never do anything, you know, whether it's our mothers and fathers or brothers and sisters, because we live in a web of relationships. There's no person who does not live in a web of relationships because we have a mother, we have a father, we have a daughter, we have a son, we have a grandfather, an uncle, an aunt, brother, sister, etc., etc. We have friends. So none of us exist outside of any kind of social relationship. So whatever we do has implications, you know, in all of these areas. So whatever actions we take, however we behave, and however we see reality has an impact, you know, on these relationships. So that's really the bottom line sense of, you know, what is skillful and not skillful. And understanding, you know, the balance of these relationships and how we exist in balance. Of course, our personal integrity, of course, is important, but that's in balance with our relationships with others. And what is the dynamic of that balance? How does that dynamic play out over time in our lives? So it could be with our parents, it could be with our siblings, it could be with our husbands, our wives, you know. And always being mindful, always being aware, right? Always being clear on, you know, these relationships. And I guess I don't need to say how difficult that is, you know, in all our relationships with everyone. I mean, there's always conflict. There's always different views of reality. There's always, you know, different conditioning patterns that create tension, conflict, anxiety. But it's this willingness to be open. The mindfulness is this willingness to be open, to examine, to feel, you know, in an open-hearted way, you know, this tension. You know, and out of that, understanding what is skillful and what is not skillful, what is hurtful and what is not hurtful. That's really important. You know, how we can hurt people sometimes without even being aware that we're hurting people. You know, and this is really the most important. Seeing things as they really are. Seeing things as they really are has sort of two meanings to it. One is called bare attention. The second is called clear comprehension. Okay, one is about how you see things, you know, the quality of your attention. The second is about how you understand, you know, clear comprehension. So these are two very, very crucially important concepts. Now, bare attention, there's a wonderful book is called The Heart of Buddhist Meditation. It's written by Nyanaponika Thera. If you ever have a chance to read it, it's really one of the foundational classics in the Buddhist literature. And Nyanaponika Thera is one of the most respected writers in the Dharma. And he spends his whole book talking about bare attention. So what it basically means, boiled down to the core, is simple, direct attention. Naked, just bare. Not making up stories about your experience, not judging, not reacting. Simple awareness of things as they are. No judgments, no reactions, no commentary. So this is the concentrated mind, right? This is the mind that's focused. This is the mind that's been noting things and loading, you know, letting things go. And you're getting to the point where you just see things, boom, as they are. Oftentimes when we speak about this, I bring up the example of Csikszentmihalyi, who is this very famous Polish, Czechoslovakian psychologist, who created the concept of what is called flow, F-L-O-W. And what that means is, all that is when you are involved in a particular activity, it could be playing a musical instrument, a sport, or, you know, the most famous examples, Bruce Lee, you know, martial arts, you know, where you're so focused on what you're doing, right? Like football or tennis or, you know, even track or running, you know, they call it runner's high, where all your thoughts go away, you know, you're not thinking, you're just completely focused on what you're doing. So it's just no thought. It's just, you know, it's like you're just automatic. That's that state of mind where, and it you know, you can have that just looking at a beautiful sunset and feeling inspired by the beauty of a sunset, or reading a beautiful poem, or writing, you know, or just being involved in an aesthetic experience, you know, painting or playing music, where that clarity of mind, so you come into that space of complete clarity of mind and you completely focus and everything sort of falls away. Okay? So this is what bare attention is. It's not, you know, it's not something special. It's just a quality of mind, you know, that we can learn to cultivate, you know, through the practice. Now the only difference in meditation is that we're doing it sitting still, you know, trying to control the mind. Whereas in most activities, you're doing something. So that, you know, there's a dynamic activity involved or physical movement. So in a way, it's easier because, you know, there's more happening. It's a more dynamic kind of, you know, situation. Whereas meditation is a little bit more difficult because you're not moving, you're sitting very still, and you're trying to quiet the mind, which is a little bit more difficult. But conceptually, it's the same thing. It's getting to that place of just complete, you know, non-reactive, non-judgmental, you know, clarity, complete mental clarity. Now, there's a famous teacher by the name of Munindra, Anagarika Munindra, who basically encapsulated the whole concept in a simple statement, which goes like this. It says, and he said, sit and know you are sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. So, when you sit, just sit. Don't be thinking about something else, or don't be, you know, just be sitting. Now, in the Satipatthana Sutta itself, it just describes the yogi going out to the forest to sit under the tree, and as he sits and he meditates, you know, it's a very beautiful kind of sutra. And he says, as he sits, he knows he is sitting. As he draws in a breath, he knows he is drawing in the breath. If, you know, as he draws in a long breath, he knows it's a long breath. As he draws in a short breath, he knows it's a short breath, etc., etc., etc. In other words, what you do is what you are. No thinking, no judgment, no reactions, just completely present. Know you are sitting. If you sit, sit. If you breathe, breathe. You know, no thought, no judgment, no reaction. This is it. This is that quality of pure presence. bear attention, mindfulness. This is that kind of mindfulness. So it's this simple awareness of exactly what is happening in the present moment. So the noting process, for example, when we say noting, you know, like if you sit and you're feeling pain, you just say pain, pain, you know, note the pain, you know, just sort of see the pain, you know, sort of experiencing it, feeling it, just turn your attention to it completely, just see it as pain, pain, sitting, sitting, breathing, breathing, you know, breathing in, be aware of breathing in, breathing out, be aware of breathing out. It's as if your whole focus is simply on what is occurring in the moment. You're not thinking about anything else. You're not daydreaming. You're not plotting and scheming or remembering or planning. You know, you're just simply in the moment. And you're, that's what in the moment means. You're completely focused on what is there. And that's it. Nothing else. So, and that's everything. Now, it sounds so elliptical. It sounds so subtle and so difficult to, you know, grab onto. And that's because our mind is so used to just winging out all the time. We're so used to proliferating, thinking about plotting, scheming, remembering, planning, right? That we're simply unable to be present. So just that being present is just being in the moment, being with the breath, with the object, completely focused, completely present, not somewhere else, in the past, in the future, or some spatially somewhere else, but right where you are. There was a very famous story that was told about the Buddha when, shortly before he died, and he was going down the road, and this wandering monk comes up to him, and he was very ill, and he died several days afterwards. And so this monk comes up and says, you know, Lord Buddha, you know, I have this pressing question, you know, I need to ask you this question. And Ananda, his attendant said, oh, can't you see he's very ill and he's very busy, it's late at night, you know, and kind of leave us alone, you know. But the Buddha, you know, saw him and said, that's okay, you know, let him come. So he comes up, and then, so he approaches the Buddha, and he says, so Lord Buddha, tell me, Bhante, what is the secret of enlightenment? So the Buddha said, you know, in 25 words or less, so the Buddha looked at him and said, when you eat, eat. When you sit, sit. When you drink, drink. And he stood there and he looked at him and he says, and in that moment, he attained enlightenment. And he just walked away. And that was the sermon. It lasted less than 30 seconds. Well, that's exactly what it is. That's what bare attention is. That's what it means to be in the moment, present. When you sit, sit. You know, there's a very famous phrase, when you chop wood, chop wood. When you carry water. Don't do anything else, just do what you're doing. And your mind should be completely present, completely focused, completely where you are. That's what it means to be in the present moment. So that's a practice. It's not so easy. I mean, you know, as I said, simple but not easy. It's very simple to understand, but it's not so easy to do. You know, it takes a practice, it takes commitment to get to that point. Clear comprehension has several meanings. And it's seeing things in many different ways as you contemplate an emotion, contemplate a mind state, contemplate a situation. And it means seeing things from all sides or from different perspectives. So it's not only your conditioned perspective by which you see something. Okay, because we all see things in a certain way. How many of you have seen the movie Rashomon? The whole point of the movie Rashomon, it was a classic by Kurosawa, and it was done in the 50s, so it's an old film. In a nutshell, it's this incident, you know, a man and his wife are traveling down the road, and they get attacked by a robber. And so, you know, and then the man is killed and the woman is raped and, you know, all kind of violence occurs. And then the robber is captured by the police, and then he's taken to jail, and the wife is, you know, somehow she survives. And then the trial occurs, and then each individual gives their version. And then there was a farmer who was watching it. You know, he was a witness. So each individual gives their version of what happened. And each version is completely different. Totally different. And then ultimately, the spirit of the man who was murdered comes back from heaven, and he gives his version of the story, and it's completely different. And so it's like, so who's telling the truth, right? What actually happened? And so the whole point of the movie is that when we see something, we're seeing it in a particular way. We think we're right, but actually, we're probably not, because if somebody else saw it, they're probably seeing a whole completely different way too. So it's this effect of conditioning and how it affects the way we see reality. But anyway, so clear comprehension means being able to see things from different perspectives, not only our own perspective. And then also it means knowing the suitability of purpose behind any action. Whether it is a benefit or not benefit to us or to other people. So this opens the possibility of making wise choices. Where is this action leading to? You know, it's not, you know, especially if, you know, it involves anger or retribution or revenge or things that will affect other people in time and space. You know, what are the implications of these effects? You know, what is the karmic sort of consequence? Also, knowing the suitability of timing behind an action. Something could be wholesome, but not the right time to say something, you know, or to do something. Sometimes it's better to exercise discretion in terms of when to say something or when to do something, even though we know it might be wholesome. Sometimes we think something is wholesome and we just do it, and we do it at the wrong time, and it ends up being unwholesome because it was not... You know, it was not done in the appropriate, within the appropriate context, you know, the appropriate situation to allow it to attain its own fruition. So this sense of judgment as to, you know, what is suitable in terms of timing, what is suitable in terms of purpose. And then third is knowing the proper domain of our mind. This is a very interesting concept. Where should our mind be in any given situation? Okay, so it's like if we're focusing on something, should our mind be, say we're trying to solve a problem, or say we're trying to help someone, or say we're in a course of actions that are leading to the, you know, the fulfillment of some objective, right? Where should the mind be? Should it be there, or should it be thinking about something else, or should it be, you know, wandering around? You see what I'm saying? In other words, what is the proper domain of where our mind should be focused in any given time, you know, in any given moment in time? So the wisdom is knowing that. And so being able to bring the mind to the proper domain, you know, where it needs to be. And of course, in meditation, of course, it's bringing the mind back to the object and not letting it, you know, wander off. So not allowing ourselves, you know, to get lost. Well, this is really important. So it's this kind of self-policing, you know, sort of what is the suitability of timing, suitability of purpose for any thought or action, you know, will it, what is the proper domain in terms of what we think, how we think, and the kinds of actions that we, you know, bring out into the world. And, you know, does it reflect a broader perspective on reality in terms of, you know, the implications of what we say or what we do. So this is all, you know, these are all the products of mindfulness. This is what mindfulness means. Of course, you know, obviously what I'm describing is wisdom, right? What I'm describing is this metta view of things, the capacity to have a larger view, the capacity to be wise, the capacity to have understanding and wisdom and judgment in terms of knowing what is appropriate and not appropriate, what is skillful and not skillful. So this is what mindfulness is. And I think it's not only good for meditation, but it's good for life. And this is really teaches us how to be, you know, good people. Now, the last one, which is, I think, the most important, and it sort of gets into the whole concept of investigation, is the knowing of non-delusion. Non-delusion. So this is knowing what is absolutely true, you know, seeing things as they truly are. Now, what this means is, and there are two sort of meanings for this, and I'll sort of run through it very quickly. The first is in the sense of meditation, in the sense of when you're in a state of concentrated focus and you start to see things, you know, without judgment, without reaction, without stories, without, you know, commentary. That's this quality of seeing things intrinsically as they are. And, you know, particularly if they're emotions like fear or anger or grief or sadness, you know, we start to see the sadness, we feel it in the body. This acronym that describes this process is called R-A-I-N, RAIN. And what it means is recognition, you know, the ability to recognize that we're feeling something. The second is acceptance, you know, the capacity to accept the fact that we might be feeling jealousy or envy or rage or anger. Sometimes it's not so easy, you know, to accept these things. And the third is investigation, the capacity to investigate, to look at what we're experiencing. And the fourth is non-attachment, you know, the capacity to not get stuck where we are, to kind of let it go, step back. And see it, you know, from a broader perspective. Okay, so this is the quality of clear seeing, right? But there's a second aspect about this which I feel is really, really important. And it's the knowing of karmic cause and effect. Now what that means is when you have, say, an epiphany, you know, you see, say, anger, it comes up. You experience it, you know, you accept it, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, where does this come from? Why am I feeling this? What are the conditions that cause this anger to arise? So you can't help but, you know, if you start to process, you can't help but to go back and to say, well, this was because so-and-so said this, and why did so-and-so say that? Because this person, he or she was... under these conditions, and blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, this whole cause and effect, you know, starts to, you know, reveal itself. And then even going forward, you know that, well, what would happen, you know, if this emotion played out, you know, under certain circumstances going forward? You know, I might get angry, I might feel vengeful, I might say something nasty, you know, it could have untoward, unskillful, unwholesome consequences. So you're seeing backward in time and you're seeing forward in time. You're starting to see the whole karmic sort of structure out of which this emotion, you know, is an expression of this whole karmic unfolding. Now, once you start to see it in that way, it's like, oh, I get it. You see what I'm saying? It's like all of a sudden what caused the anger almost just disappears. You know, there's this understanding and a kind of acceptance. It's like understanding Osama bin Laden. It's like, oh, I understand why he did what he did, you know. It's like, oh, okay, I get it. And that awakening, that moment of epiphany, that moment of clear seeing, allows acceptance, right? And in a way, it allows forgiveness. It doesn't change the situation. You know, a hurtful, unskillful thing might have happened, and you still might act to change the situation to move in a more wholesome way. But you're seeing it with a much larger, broader perspective, the karmic perspective. And this is really sort of the key in terms of, you know, what it means to see clearly.